Interview with Captain John Mason, 14 of April, 1997. Mr. Mason, perhaps we could start with a brief history of your service with the RCN, when you joined up, and any education and training as an engineer before we move forward to the Buckingham and Ottawa trials.
Okay, well, I joined the RCNVR at the end of 1942 as a second-class stoker. And shortly after that, I was selected for ERA apprentice training at Galt, Ontario, which started in February of 43. We trained there for about 10 months, and subsequently at Hamilton for internal combustion engines and the MTE in Halifax. In all, we spent about 17 months in wartime undergoing training. We then went to sea as stokers first class to undertake the duties of a stoker first class, including boiler rooms, the engine room, cleaning bilges, boilers, greasing, for 6 months, after which we were promoted to acting ERA fourth class if we'd obtained our auxiliary watchkeeping certificates. My first ship, in fact, was a four-stacker, HMCS Niagara, for about 3 weeks, which was enough. And then I went to stand by a new ship building, HMCS Fort Erie, in Lauzon, Quebec. When I became an ERA fourth class, I was drafted to HMCS Antigonish as an ERA fourth class, which was refitting in Pictou, Nova Scotia, in preparation for the Pacific War. Before we did get to the Pacific, however, the war was over, and I was discharged in December of 1945 and used my DVA credits to acquire a degree in mechanical engineering at the University of Toronto. Upon graduation, there were thousands of engineers and not that many jobs. I had tentatively accepted a job with CIL at their plant in Belle Isle, Quebec, for $210 a month, out of which I'd have to pay room and board. When a letter arrived from the Army, from REME, offering me a commission as a second lieutenant for $235 a month, with room and board provided. And so this was very tempting. I didn't really know anything about the Army, but I went down to HMCS York with this letter, and they said, well, we don't have anything like that, Mr. Mason, thank you very much. So I was packing, getting ready to go to Belle Isle, Quebec, when I had a call from the recruiting officer at HMCS York, who incidentally happened to be Ward Palmer, who's living here in Victoria today. Asked me to come down for a talk, and cut a long story short, I passed a board in Ottawa, and after some officer training, divisional training in Halifax, I was off to the UK for training at the Royal Naval Engineering College at Keyham and subsequently Manadon. I went to sea for a year in a British cruiser, HMS Kenya, based in Hong Kong, and we were there at the outbreak of the Korean War, which we thought would last just a few weeks or at most a month, and we'd be back in Hong Kong for Christmas. However, that was not the case. It was a long, drawn-out affair. I spent a very interesting year in that ship. I very quickly was assigned my own watch in the engine room because they were short of watchkeepers. They also discovered I'd had some considerable experience before and during the war. My nickname was Canada, being the only one on board, so I had certain privileges. I went back to the UK for another year at the Royal Naval Engineering College and came back to Canada, where I was posted to HMCS Quebec as a watchkeeping engineer officer. I spent nearly 2 years in that ship and then was posted to stand by a frigate being refitted and rebuilt at Vickers, HMCS Buckingham, about April of 1954. The ship commissioned and went through workups, and I was in that ship for almost a year and a half, at which time they were considering putting a temporary helicopter platform on board. I was there when that was being installed, but to the best of my knowledge, I was posted out of the ship back to Vickers to stand by HMCS Ottawa before Buckingham actually got to sea for trials. And we commissioned Ottawa in Montreal in November of 1956. And subsequently, I believe, that platform, or a modified version of it, was transferred to Ottawa. So it seemed to me that this thing was following me around. And we did do trials in that ship with an RCAF helicopter. And an RCAF pilot and a civilian mechanic. I remember the mechanic's name. His name was Jock, a real Scot. And I can't remember the pilot's name. And we did trials in and around Halifax. And we then went across to the UK with the 5th Squadron and, I believe, Magnificent. Yes, Magnificent, certainly. And concern was, there was concern about the support of the blades of the helicopter because it didn't have folding blades, if I remember. So we contacted Magnificent, and the senior engineer, Johnny Frank, had a solution. He was going to send over some boiler tubes, which we could jury-rig as supports for the blades, which he did. And this worked out very fine indeed to permit the blades from swaying around as the ship rolled, which it did plenty of. No stabilizers in those days. Also, the helicopter was quite often subject to salt spray and even solid salt water perching up high on the quarterdeck. So we took a goodly supply of our precious fresh water to keep it washed down. The squadron was proceeding to the Baltic for a Baltic cruise, but in those days the enemy was the USSR, and they didn't want them to have a good look at this thing at all. So, much to our dismay and disappointment, we were sent into Londonderry while the rest of the squadron enjoyed themselves up in the Baltic. Now, I don't recall a great deal more than that. We certainly went back to Canada. The RCF helicopter flew away, and the platform was removed. I can't give you any great deals of details about the actual trials, because that was not my part of the ship. Well, should I go on?
Well, perhaps we can just go back for a moment and let discuss what your training, what was involved in your training at the Royal Naval Engineering College in the UK. That was a refresher course, if I remember correctly. You already had a degree from the University in Toronto as an engineer, completed a four-year program, I would assume. Mm-hmm. So what sort of different courses would you be taking at the engineering college in the UK as opposed to what you would have done as an undergraduate at the University of Toronto?
Well, of course, in Toronto was a very general engineering course, and although we'd taken some steam theory, what the course in the UK dwelt upon was marine engineering specifically, and naval marine engineering, the kinds of machinery and equipment that one would find in a naval ship, and its maintenance and operation. So that is the difference, and that was something I did not learn at Toronto. And at that time, and up until quite recently, I believe, the Navy has sent all of its engineers to the UK for training in marine engineering. Although I understand that recently Manadon has closed, and that the naval engineers are now being trained through some of the universities.
I see. So you were engineer officer aboard Buckingham just prior to the trials, but the platform was being fitted aboard ship at that time.
That's right. Yeah.
Then you leave and you're posted to Ottawa.
HMCS Ottawa.
HMCS Ottawa. And she receives the platform following the Buckingham trial.
That's right.
Now, if I remember correctly, that's a larger platform than what was on Buckingham, because for the Buckingham trials, it was an S-55 Sikorsky helicopter.
Yes.
But for the Ottawa trials, it was the larger S-58 helicopter, which was borrowed from the RCAF for those trials.
Okay.
Were you, what role did you have to play as it related to the fitting of the platform aboard Ottawa?
Well, virtually none, because that was done by the dockyard and in association with the team that was doing the trials from Shearwater. I was an observer as opposed to a participant.
Right.
Providing assistance where required, but the whole operation was, the installation was supervised by the dockyard, the experts in ship construction and design, to make sure there wasn't any excess strain put on the ship's structure.
So during those, the Ottawa trials, what sort of role did you then play if you had to lend assistance?
Well, I think I've mentioned that we provided them assistance where required in the way of providing facilities, certainly water for washing down. I can't recall that we were called upon other than that. I mentioned the supports for the rotor blades.
Which were built aboard the ship?
The supports were built on aboard the ship from boiler tubes.
Oh, really?
Provided by Magnificent.
And this was just a stopgap measure to keep the
something.
To keep the rotor blades, because of their length and weight.
That's right.
From bending and or breaking.
Well, they were flexing quite a lot as the ship rolled and pitched, carrying the helicopter up and down with it, of course.
So how were the supports tied to the deck to keep them in place, as well as the rotor blades?
They were secured to the deck with. I believe, I can't remember precisely, I don't think they were actually secured to the deck. They were supported by a makeshift arrangement of ropes, wires, and so on, and the blades held down on top of them. Sort of A-frames were made out of the boiler tubes.
Oh, I see.
And these sat on the deck, and the upper end was used to support the rotor blade near its tip, with a pad of something like gunny sacking.
Right.
And then the rotor blade itself was lashed down to the deck.
Oh, I see.
So it held
all right.
It in place. It was very jury-rigged, but it seemed to work.
And this was used throughout the trials.
Yes.
Which
yes.
Took place off of Florida, if I remember correctly.
Some of them did. I recall specifically the part that took us across the Atlantic.
Right, which was, side. I think, the second part of the trials.
Yes, that's right, yes.
First to Florida,
yes.
And then across the North Atlantic
there for
to the UK.
Florida, yes.
Now, you're crossing the North Atlantic in the late fall, I believe.
Yes, it was.
And you could experience some pretty heavy weather and seas.
We did do.
And you're talking about a fairly large and heavy helicopter with no hangar available for the trials.
That's right.
It's securely lashed down,
yes,
but
right.
I'm sure that people were particularly concerned about any movement of that aircraft on that deck.
Well, that's right. It was well lashed down. The bosun's party took it upon themselves to provide expertise and assistance in lashing it to the deck. The ship was rolling considerably, and as I said earlier, the helicopter got wet with seawater, which didn't do it any good at all. The additional top weight was not particularly noticeable because we never let our fuel oil get that low that we were in any way unstable. It was not a concern.
Magnificent was cruising with Ottawa for those trials.
We were in company with Magnificent.
So if fuel oil did get low, you could have been fueled from the carrier?
We were fueled from Magnificent.
Oh, you were?
On at least one and perhaps several occasions.
All right.
Yeah.
I understand from some of the documents that quite detailed preparations were followed in order to protect the aircraft from the salt, from the sea spray, such as heavily waxing the aircraft,
yes,
to protect it,
yes,
tarps over certain portions of the,
yes,
aircraft,
yes,
to protect that from the salt itself. But you mentioned that the aircraft had to be washed down to keep,
yes,
salt off, or to cut,
yes,
it down as much as possible, because these other measures were not were not sufficient, and this led to problems for fresh water aboard the ship, I assume.
Well, the engineer officer is always concerned about the supply of fresh water on board a ship, or at least was in those days, because the priority for water goes to the ship's boilers of a steamship, and anything left over can be used by the crew if available. And I was concerned by the amount of the free use of my precious fresh water being used to hose down this this helicopter. I understood the need for it, just that it was a concern.
And I understand that the washing of the aircraft would take place at least once a day when the aircraft was flying.
Certainly as soon as it landed, they were taking great care of it. And I think occasionally, if it was sometimes it was the weather was too terrible to fly it even, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There was no haul down in those days. It just flew off whenever it could. They would also wash it down in heavy weather frequently.
But most, I guess, in the heavy weather, there was the aircraft was securely lashed to the deck. There was no aircraft handlers out there trying to maneuver it on the deck at all.
You couldn't have,
because it had just gone overboard.
That's right. No, it was securely lashed.
So you're talking about a fairly large aircraft. I mean, smaller than a Sea King, but it would have required quite a bit of water to wash down this aircraft on a daily basis when they could fly the aircraft.
That's right.
So what sort of measures were taken to alleviate the fresh water problem aboard the ship for crew and boilers and meeting the needs of the aviation people?
Well, quite often in a ship in those days, we'd have water hours. Water would be only available for showering at certain times, and I'm sure that was in effect. As long as both evaporators were operating, we could probably cope with it. And as I recall, during that trip, we were never in a desperate situation for water. We just took due precautions not to waste it.
Right, okay. Do you remember anything else during the trials in Ottawa, either down to operate off the coast of Florida or across to the UK, where your services were required in order to make repairs or assist the naval aviators with any repair work that was done as a result of heavy damage?
I recall that when we arrived in Belfast, that aircraft flew off to what's the manufacturer in the UK to have some modifications done to it?
Bristol or Westland?
Westland. The people in that make that aircraft. They made a British version of it under
license, right?
Under license. And I'm not sure what they had done to it, but something needed doing. And it was flown off by the pilot and a civilian technician. And they were gone for the duration of our stay in Belfast, which was about a week or so. I wish I could recall what it was. I did know at the time.
Right.
What they had to have done to the airplane. And I can't remember.
Were there any other incidents where you were asked to lend your assistance based upon your expertise to help out with the trials?
Well, I can't remember, I'm afraid. I don't think so.
Whose idea was it for jury rigging the rotor blades so that they would not be damaged in transit?
It probably was mine, because we didn't have anything long enough or strong enough to act as supports for the rotors. So I presume that Magnificent might have something. I was really thinking of timbers to start with, to do this with. And I spoke to Johnny Frank, the senior engineer, on radio. He said, well, what about boiler tubes? I said, okay, let's try it. So over they came by Jack Stay, a great bundle of boiler tubes.
Was he aboard Magnificent at the time?
Yes, yes.
And he was in the director of air engineering?
No, he was the senior engineer, which in a big ship is the second in command of the engineering department. There would be a commander E.
Right.
A commander who was the engineer officer, the chief engineer, and the second in command who ran the department for him was called a senior engineer. At that time it was Johnny Frank, who also was an air engineer.
Right, okay.
It so happened he was not doing air engineering duties at that time.
At that time. So this must have been earlier because I, in conversations with a number of other individuals, they had made mention of the fact that he was posted to the director of air engineering in Ottawa in 1955, 1956. So he must have been on his next assignment.
He was next. He was then, yes, he'd come from Ottawa. That's right.
And to witness the trials and to lend his assistance.
I don't know whether it was really connected with the trials. I think he was posted to Magnificent as the senior engineer, period.
Oh, I see. All right. Okay.
But he was interested in the trials, obviously.
Right, because of his previous exposure to the program. So between the two of you, you were able to rig up something to help out the
That's right.
Individuals.
Yes, I give due credit to my shipwright, of course, who scratched his head and looked at these boiler tubes and with some cutting and welding and jury rigging, we managed to build some A-frames for it.
During the trials, were you asked to rig up any other sort of equipment for the aviators so that they could carry out their trials? Any lights to help out the landing signal officers for landing
there
the helicopter?
There was no night flying.
No night flying?
No.
It was just strictly daytime flying?
Absolutely, and in fair weather.
In fair weather.
Yeah. Because the aircraft was awkward to handle, and that you couldn't have recovered it in any kind of a pitching deck.
Do you remember if during the crossing of the North Atlantic, I assume that they probably didn't get very much flying time at all then?
That's right. There were a few days, but not very many, that they could fly it.
And do you ever remember when they were off the coast of Florida hearing...
Florida's a different thing. I'm talking about this trip to the UK and the Baltic.
Right.
Florida, the weather was fine.
I know that from talking to some of the pilots as it relates to the early aircraft, when they used to fly off of Florida.
Now, let's see. Let me get back to Florida again. We did some trials out of Key West without the helicopter platform.
All right.
They flew on to reinforced mortar well covers. In those days, we had twin mortars and anti-submarine mortars in a well with quite light aluminum covers. And what had been done was to reinforce those covers with, I think, damage control timbers so they could accept the weight of, was it the
S-58? The S-55 for
the Navy was flying. Navy was flying them down.
Right.
And there was several of our Canadian Navy pilots were on exchange. I remember Ken Gibbs particularly was one of those involved. And we did trials landing those on the reinforced mortar covers to see, just to determine the concept.
I have a photo of HMCS Saint Laurent 1955 showing that very same thing with some timbers underneath the aft mortar well to in order for the aircraft to land on the mortar well.
Yes.
Which was obviously a temporary arrangement.
Yes.
What else would have to be done to shore up those mortar wells?
Well, I think that was the prime thing. Not much else. It was certainly a temporary ad hoc arrangement, done only in fair weather.
And that was...
They had a landing signals officer on board.
Not very much room on the stern of a Saint Laurent because they didn't... They didn't cut away. I'm not sure of the term, and you can help me out in this regard. The wire that runs down the length of the ship on either side, starboard and port, with
the guardrails.
The guardrails.
No, I can't remember. I think we lowered the guardrails, but you must remember the helicopter rotor was very high above the helicopter, above the deck in any case. I don't think we needed to lower the guardrails.
I was just thinking in terms of if they encountered a gust of wind and the aircraft was kind of blown off when it was in a hover, catching its wheels and undercarriage on the guardrails.
I don't remember the guardrails being lowered. And that was certainly it was a dicey operation.
Very little room to maneuver there.
Yeah.
Very little room.
Very
to maneuver.
Big airplane, a very small area.
So these, the...
So that helicopter platform was fitted after those trials at Key West.
Right. So that it could take part in the next phase of the trials, which were in the fall
of
1957.
When we did go across the UK.
And I think it was, I think if I remember correctly, it was a three-week... I hesitate to use the word exercise, but
deployment,
yeah. Where they were testing the S-58 aboard Ottawa.
Yeah.
When you talk about the aft mortar well being shored up with the timbers from below, how thick were the lids for the aft mortar wells?
Well, roughly? They were made of aluminum, so two men could lift one. I guess they'd be about half-inch aluminum, bent in a U-shape. And there were three of them over each mortar, or was it four? So they had to be shored up considerably. They were not.
You're supporting a 10,000-pound aircraft
not terribly strong.
No.
And it seemed to work.
So for the shoring up of the mortar well hatches, would that have used up quite a bit of the timbers that were aboard the ship so that they couldn't be used if they were required for damage control?
Well, yes, they would. But if I recall, we were provided with additional shoring because it was determined we'd need this for the exercise. After the trials in Key West, it had used up a lot of our shoring. Don't remember that there was any problem with that. We had sufficient.
And during the trials, do you remember if the aft mortar well hatches were shored up during the entire time that Ottawa was down operating off of Key West? Or would the shoring come out so that they could use the ASW mortars for other parts of the trials?
That's a good point. The shoring was so temporary, it could easily be removed. And I don't recall we actually used the mortars during that time. I don't think there was ASW exercises with a submarine involved. And even so, we'd never have really fired the mortars.
Right.
We'd only have simulated firing.
Right. But that would have meant that the mortars would have had to have been up and the hatches off.
Yeah.
It raises the question that if it was a temporary arrangement, how much time would be involved in order to either take away the shoring or to put it back up in place in order to land the aircraft on board the aft mortar well?
Well, once it was cut to the right lengths, it could be removed quickly and then put back quickly.
So a few men, maybe 20 minutes or so,
would that be a good guess? I would say that, yes.
And even probably less time to take it all down.
If they'd done it more frequently enough, it would have taken less time than that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Very quick arrangement then.
Particularly if they're familiar with the various parts of the shoring and had marked it properly. I don't recall that was really a problem.
Was that normal procedure to mark the timbers so that they would be fitted into the right place?
I would like to hope so, but I can't be sure.
All right, okay. It would depend upon who was actually doing
right.
it, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else that you remember of the trials either off of... Key West, or on the crossing over to Londonderry that was particularly interesting? I know that you encountered some fairly heavy weather in the crossing of the North Atlantic, and that the platform was probably, as well as the ship, taking a bit of a beating.
Yes. I can't add anything to what we've said already. I really can't. I'm sorry about that. As I say, I was not directly involved. I was an interested spectator. And I provided assistance when needed, and that's about all.
How would you describe the relationship between the people that were aboard, the naval aviators, the scientists that were there attending the trials, and the ship's crew, the surface fleet?
Well, I think we were... polite as possible. We always tolerated visitors on board, which we called passengers, of course. The rest of us were working crew. I think we were civil to them, tried to make them feel comfortable in the home.
Were the conditions somewhat crowded during the trials?
Of course.
A lot of extra men and equipment aboard?
Yes. Well, we were crowded and so were they, so we shared mutual discomfort.
I have one additional question that's just come up that may or may not affect you personally. Fueling of the aircraft, from your perspective, what sort of arrangements were required?
Well, it was very dicey. They had drums of aviation fuel, because that was not a jet airplane. It used high-octane aviation gas, stored on the deck, lashed down. They used a hand pump, like an old-fashioned well pump, back and forth, reciprocating pump to refuel the aircraft. They refueled it through a chamois, and I think we arranged that for them. We made a chamois for them to filter the fuel through, because a chamois catches water, apparently. They were concerned about water being in the fuel. So refueling took considerable time, and there was always a fire guard standing by. We were very concerned about no smoking on the upper deck, naturally.
Right.
Or anywhere near the aircraft when that was taking place.
I'll just stop it here and flip the tape over.